a lonely person, or you live alone, you're on welfare, you receive $550 a month, and when you live in a 3.5 that costs, let's say, $450, you have $100 left for the rest of the month. So try to eat and to feed yourself and to buy clothes and to have a decent living. It's impossible. So it's not a question of drug addiction or any kind of other addiction.
Do you know how widespread that problem is? Like, I know the definition of poverty, I believe, is that you spend a certain percentage of your income on food and shelter, and I'm wondering what percentage of the population here would be spending the greater part of their income on those basic necessities.
Well, according to the government of Canada, the Statistics Canada, there a family lives under poverty rate or poverty level when a family pays more than 30% of its rent of its income for rent. And in Quebec, well, from the last census numbers, there's over 450,000 families in Quebec that pay more than 30% of their rent of their income for rent. So that's a good idea.
And that figures even higher here on the island of Montreal.
Yes.
Carol, you're back with us. I had posed you a question there before we lost you, and that question was, how much of an impact has your research and your work on homelessness in BC had on the perception of homelessness in BC? You've had this study released now for almost a year. In which ways is the research that you turned up serving to challenge the very common perceptions that people have of homeless people?
Well, for one thing, there's an awareness now that there is, in fact, homelessness in a rural setting. Everybody thinks that if you live in the country, you're doing just fine because probably you grow your own veggies and everything else is dandy. So that definitely is a picture that has increased. And I think very similar to the last speaker who said it's an awful lot about the cost of housing and that the lack of affordable housing. Anybody is at risk of being homeless. I mean, they're, but for the grace of God, right, one paycheck away for many, many people. And I think it's been surprising. And I think we turned up a much higher than expected education level. So there were people with university degrees. There were people that were stereotypically very well educated who were homeless or at risk of being homeless, and that was surprising to many folks. So that was good to make that obvious.
1-866-763-4136 is the number to join us online. We'd like to again please invite Tumavith Youth Center in Toronto from the Native Men's Residence to please call in. We would love to have you join this discussion, and anybody else who is listening and is touched by this issue and has a perspective to share. 1-866-763-4136. We have a gentleman on the line named Corey who's been trying to get on for quite a while. We apologize for having you wait. Corey, are you there?
I think Allison is still on the line. Allison?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Did you wanna add further comment? I know that we've kind of taken the discussion off in a couple of different directions, but you said you had a couple different things that you wanted to talk about.
Well, my experience proves what Carol is saying is true. The woman in rural BC, because the people are from such a diverse background that the stereotypes are incredibly painful and distressing. It's maybe even more so in the U.S. where you find people can go overnight downhill, due to a loss of health care or housing and such. But the same is true in Canada. That was my experience in one big city. I eventually was squeezed out of my various apartments as I moved around the city trying to find affordable housing. And I was paying about 75% of my income and ended up in some dangerous work situations that I would not have chosen otherwise because I was trying to keep it going. And
can you talk about that a bit more, Allison, as someone who's personally experienced that level of survival on the streets?
There's so many more that I met who had much more extreme experiences, but I would say that the ending up in working in sex trade and other illegal industries are a problem, because a common problem for people without secure housing, because you're constantly trying to keep out of further problems, and then you end up in it can be a cycle of problems that are directly related to the housing and gentrification problem, because you end up trying harder and harder with less and less, and it's a squeeze. And you know, there are pockets of places where people can survive, but it's so difficult, and the stress is so great that this is partly why people take drugs, is because they either need to relieve the stress, you know, the stress that's unbelievable to people who haven't experienced it, and also because, or a desire to relieve the stress, and also it's not safe to go to sleep outside, and so people do other types of drugs so that they are not asleep, because it's especially dangerous for women to let your guard down in these situations. So these things all relate.
In which ways do you find that government policy is complicit in creating these situations that you yourself found yourself in? That women are finding themselves increasingly in today, not only in the streets, but in their own homes. There was a study recently released demonstrating the grave impact that poor housing is having on women's health across Canada, especially poor women's health, and that was a study that was just released today. In which ways do you, Allison, and I'd ask Carol and Louis the same thing, in which ways do you find that the government's complicit in creating these situations for these growing populations on the streets across Canada?
I really noticed it first in Vancouver, when there was increasingly nowhere to live. That was where you would not be assaulted by people with drug addictions coming into your home, a home which is rented at an exorbitant rate and is barely providing the basic, shelter, and is not secure. I think security is an issue that is for everyone, but I think that women can really feel it too, you know.
Louis, do you have some comment on government complicity?
Well, in Quebec, in many ways, the government is a complice, or I don't know if the exact word, but in many ways, because it's impossible. Well, without controlling the price of the rents in Montreal or in anywhere, it's impossible for people to pay their rent because of the income they receive, and also the lack of vision of the government, meaning that all the housing programs that they put in are only a short-term program, one-year program, helping people for a short while, and afterwards letting them on the private market facing slumlords that only have profits in mind.
Yeah.
And Carol, your thoughts on that? Did your report turn up any evidence of government complicity?
Well, not so much a report, but I work at the advocacy center, and we have worked forever with anybody living in poverty, and absolutely, when welfare rates are set at miles below the poverty rate, that's being very complicit. And when EI rules became, stricter and harder and shorter to get, that's another way of being complicit. And when they pull money out of building affordable housing, that is another terrible way of being complicit. In BC now, I mean, the money is going to supported living, but that means that regular old poor folks, there's no new affordable housing being built.
Yeah.
Allison, did you have a final comment there? I'd like to clear the line so that we can take other callers on 1-866-763-4136. That's 1-866-763-4136 to join this national forum broadcasting coast to coast here in Canada.
Yeah, I did have something where I think the government is dropping the ball, if not entirely responsible. Here in Winnipeg, there's an endless development of the suburbs. Even though there's a great concern to revive the downtown, people don't, that's a long-standing problem where people don't like to come downtown because the conditions are so bad. And what this means is that there's a fear built in to the people who are working that it's not a safe place to have their children. And so then the people who are left down here get worse and worse conditions. And so for every big development project, which is, of mutual support to the corporations, the development corporations and the government, there's maybe one or two smaller developments that are, you know, low income and not such great quality and much more crowded and no long-term vision for the people who remain downtown because it's reasonable.
Thank you, Allison. I would like to make a special request for the callers. If there's if there are any Aboriginal listeners out there, we know that of the growing populations, there are many different groups that are not included in the stereotype of who the homeless are on the streets. And I know in Toronto there's a population of Aboriginal students who, because of the impossible prices of rent in that city, combined with tuition, are forced into some serious situations. And I'd like to invite anybody who's listening, who finds themselves in that situation, to please call 1-866-763-4136. Again, 1-866-763-4136 if you're an Aboriginal person in Canada on the streets. Or perhaps if you're a family that's under threat, having difficulty making your rent or seeing your neighborhood become pricier and pricier, maybe worried about finding yourselves on the street, families threatened by homelessness. 1-866-763-4136. We're talking about the growing population on the streets. We're broadcasting live from the Café sur la Rue on the streets of Montreal. 30 stations across Canada are joining us in this special broadcast. We're CKUT 90.3 FM, and we invite you to call and share your perspectives on homelessness. This is a special broadcast that we did first time last year. This is the second national broadcast. We spoke a little bit earlier with the Homelessness Marathon in the U.S., which is in their seventh year. And with us on the streets is Louis, who is an activist with a tenants association representing a neighborhood in Montreal's southwest that has experienced some severe gentrification. It's not the only neighborhood in Montreal that's experiencing that. I don't know if you're that familiar with some of the other other towns or other neighborhoods and boroughs that have been amalgamated in the megacity. The amalgamation is something that's affecting many cities. Montreal, for the last 2 years, has gone through a lot of changes as various independent cities and boroughs have become part of the megacity. Has that influenced what we've seen in the southwest? And can you maybe talk a little bit about some of the other neighborhoods that are also experiencing gentrification?
Well, I'm sorry. Usually the neighborhoods that are the first targets of gentrification are what we could say a popular neighborhood or neighborhood that used to be poor, or if I could say, because their main interest is the low cost of housing, the low cost of the ground, the ground over there, and that's why they are a great interest for investors, because it's cheap to buy, and it's great profit to make. So, in the southwest, especially the Saint-Henri neighborhood, Pointe Saint-Charles, it used to be a low income neighborhood, and so it's the same for Hochelaga, Maisonneuve, Centre Sud, who are facing the same situation. 30 years ago, the Plateau Mont-Royal in Montreal was also a popular neighborhood, and that was slowly changed into a yuppie neighborhood or a more wealthier neighborhood. And it's also the same in Quebec City, the neighborhood the Saint Jean Baptiste, which had the same characteristic. So it's usually neighborhood that were poor and that are the target of the promoters and people who want to invest and more and make a larger profit with these neighborhoods.
What are the kind of suggestions, demands, recommendations are you and other tenant associations in Montreal making towards the government to stop this this increase of development that's causing so much displacement? In which ways are you advocating that the government do something tomorrow?
Well, there's maybe two sides of demands. The first one, and the principal one, is we ask the every government, the city, the province, and the federal government to finance the construction of new social housing all across the province and all across Canada in order to make people stay in their neighborhood, to give them the opportunity to pay a low income that's proportional to their low rent, that's proportional to their income. And the other demand that we ask is to the government to take action to control the private market, maybe in expropriating careless landlords, expropriating landlords in areas that are more targeted by gentrification in order to build new social housing, and also to control, and well, in Quebec the rent control still exists, and we ask the government of Quebec to make it more strict, the control of rent.
Carol, are you also on the line?
I am.
In what ways are you making demands of the government in BC regarding the work that you've done there? If you were in a position to make demands of the government, and if they were actually gonna, no, I'm kidding. What would you say though? What would you ask of the government, either in BC, at the provincial level, at the municipal level, or at the federal level? What would you ask for tomorrow?
Well, I think both federally and provincially need to pour, number one, more money into building affordable housing, and to staffing the housing that where folks are having a lot of difficulties. So I might want to say the hard to house folks who have health problems and have troubles. There are no staffing dollars. We, for example, in Nelson have a set of rooms available for short-term transitional housing, and there are no staffing dollars anywhere. So money for affordable housing to be built and staffed is critical, and then welfare rates that are livable. Not going to happen, though, I don't think, in the near future.
Well, we do have Corey on the line from Toronto. Corey, are you there?
Yes, I am.
We've been talking this last hour about the perception of homeless people and how that perception is currently under challenge regarding the growing populations that we have on the streets across Canada now. We see growing populations of women, we see growing populations of youth, but we don't see services available to them, and they're resorting to many, many things just to survive on the streets of Canada. We've also talked about gentrification and the links between development and displacement of these growing populations. In which ways do you see this happening on the ground there in Toronto?
Well, let me think. The first thing I think I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, just in regarding the displacement of people out of affordable housing into inaffordable situations. We have tenants in Quebec and in Montreal who are paying upwards of almost a half of their rent, of their income to rent. And that's putting many people in situations where they just can't afford the rent. And so you have more and more people who are spending time on the streets, whether they're on the streets and off the streets repeatedly throughout the year or throughout their lifetime. But it's happening more and more. And we see more women and more youth on the streets across Canada. Do you see this? Do you see this in Toronto? And I apologize for the very brutal wind that we're experiencing right now in Montreal. But it's quite cold outside.
Yeah, no, I used to live there. With regard to the question, my personal belief, okay, being somebody who's been on the streets off and on for the last 16 years, I used to work with an organization here in Toronto, and one of the biggest issues regarding homelessness with the youth is the fact that there aren't enough services, there aren't enough shelters, transitional homes, co-ops or anything of that sort for youth or single families or anything like that that are on the street or at risk of being on the street, to basically give them assistance to get themselves back, or like get themselves established again. Welfare isn't offering any type of re-education programs, upgrading programs, employment opportunities that I've been aware of. I mean, I've been in and out of the system, like I said, for 16 years, and very few times have I ever been offered anything, any kind of educational or employment opportunity, employment training opportunities from any kind of assistance worker that I've dealt with in my past. On top of that, you know, I mean, like I said, the government isn't participating. I don't know where their interests lie. I mean, for example, as I believe I mentioned to one of you earlier, you know, I was reading in the paper the other day about the Ontario government and the federal government, and I believe Toronto's involved in this as well with regard to what I consider to be a ridiculous undergoing, which is the reconstruction of the Ontario Art Gallery, which was estimated at $194 million. I mean, why take that kind of money, $194 million, invested in a project like that when I believe it's still in good running condition, and you can take that money and divert it into services like re-education and employment training opportunities for people that are low income and at risk of being homeless, so that it gives them the opportunity to re-educate themselves and try to stay established or try to keep up with the work, try to keep up with
the growing populations there.
Yeah.
Corey, it sounds like you're saying that the government does have opportunities to resolve some of the situations for homeless people in this country, but they're just not implementing their solutions or the priorities wrong. What do you think's at issue here? Why is the government failing?
I think the government's failing because it's not taking a sincere enough interest. I believe that, you know, I mean, I just personally believe that, you know, these are people that have never experienced what it's like to be homeless or in transition or anything like that. Therefore, I don't think they have a clear understanding of what's really going on. And on top of that, I don't believe that they really have an interest in knowing what's going on. You know, I mean, like that gentleman said from the States, you know, you just take them, push them aside and pretend like they don't exist. You know,
yeah.
and then take monies that could be used for services such as, you know, low-income health care, low-income re-education or employment training opportunities, and diverted to ridiculous projects like, you know, renovating places such as the Ontario Art Gallery or other ridiculous projects.
Carol, I'd like to get your response to this. We're going to have to close up the discussion because we are on the end of the hour. Carol, do you have any final comments for this discussion on growing populations, or do you have any response to some of the issues here that Corey's raised?
I totally agree. I think that on some level there's a whole portion of the population that's just discardable, and somebody's benefiting. There's some reason behind why our society needs a whole class of folks that don't get to work and don't get to equally participate in society. So it's about politics, it's about capitalism, it's about, who wants to have more and who wants to make sure somebody doesn't have enough.
Carol, I want to thank you very much for joining us at this very late hour here on the streets of Montreal. Corey, I want to thank you for your persistence and thank you very much for getting your comments in on this panel. Thanks, Corey. Thanks, Carol.
Thank you very much.
Louis.
Stay warm.
Thank you.
We'll try to stay warm as it is dropping below 20.
The wind
keeps getting stronger and stronger here. We actually have a number of windstorms that keep just circulating down the street here. We're going to say goodbye to our phone callers and set you up, all of our listeners across Canada, broadcasting from coast to coast here on Canada's second annual homelessness marathon, providing a very necessary discussion for talking about and reflecting on how we can end homelessness tomorrow. Sophie's here to line up the next hour for us. She's going to be hosting the next hour. It's going to be a panel looking at the relationship between addiction and media hype. You've already heard us talk about addiction several times on this broadcast already, but Sophie's going to join us for a thorough discussion, an hour looking at addiction and media hype. Sophie?
Yes, hello, Gretchen. I'll begin in French for this presentation. So, drogue et itinérance, un mélange médiatique sensationnel qui sert souvent davantage les tenants de la répression au détriment des organisations qui viennent en aide aux toxicomanes. Les drogues sont plus souvent qu'autrement présentées par les médias grand public comme un fléau généralisé chez les personnes sans-abri, image choc à l'appui, bien sûr. Alors, comment les réseaux d'aide jugent-on l'impact du traitement journalistique médiatique trop souvent alarmiste de cet enjeu social sur les personnes itinérantes? Dans la prochaine heure, donc, nous allons réunir des journalistes et des intervenants sociaux pour faire la lumière sur ce qui en est vraiment de l'usage des drogues sur la rue. Alors, so I'm going to say it in English right now. Drugs and homelessness, a sensational mix that promotes repression over help to addicts. Medias are often using drugs and addiction as a general stereotype of homeless people, displaying shocking images and alarming the public. What is the impact of this sensationalism on homeless people, and how do homeless networks view and work around these images? In the next hour or so, we'll gather journalists and social workers to help us see the reality of drugs in the streets. So please stay with us and come and just keep in mind to the phone number, the toll-free number, 1-866-763-4136. Call us in the next hour to tell us about what you think about medias and addictions.
Me and my boyfriend and a friend decided we were going to move across the country. We bought a car and we made it as far as Nelson, BC, which was our original destination. We camped out on a beach. There were a lot of other kids living on the beach, and you know, at first it was just like a rugged camping adventure, but jobs were scarce in the community of Nelson, and it was really difficult to make money, and apartments and housing was minimal. It became a sudden reality. My name is Shannon, and I currently reside in Sackville, New Brunswick. My first homelessness experience was when I was 19. At that time, I was very much ashamed of having become homeless because I felt like I was a failure for not living up to the standards of our community. I lost a lot of faith in myself at my ability to provide.